Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Once again, everyone, I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. At 15, Sonia Cristina was studying drama while sharing a billing with such luminaries as Sandy Denny, Al Stewart, and Buffy St. Marie. Sonia, a barefoot hippie wild child whose friends in the late 60s were radical revolutionaries, Hell's Angels, writers and poets and celebrated musicians, played Chrissy in the original London cast of Hair in 1968. In 1970, Sonia Cristina became the voice of Curved Air. Curved Air soon became renowned for their virtuosity and thrilling shows. Their albums were top 20 bestsellers, as was the single hit Backstreet Love. The influential original members were electric violinist Daryl Way, electronica pioneer and guitarist, keyboard player Francis Mockman, and drummer Florian Pilkington Mixa. From 1970 to the present day, Sonia Cristina has been the one constant member of Curved Air. 1973, 17-year-old Eddie Jobson, who also played in Roxy Music and Frank Zappa, replaced both Monkman and Way during the Air Cut era. In 74 through 76, Stuart Copeland came straight from college to critical acclaim as Curved Air's drummer. At the end of 76, Curved Air broke up, and Sonia had a ringside seat at the birth of punk and the astronomic rise of Stuart's band, The Police, during Sonia and Stuart's 16-year relationship. By 1989, Sonia Cristina reinvented folk rock with a fiery brand of music she dubbed acid folk. Curved Air's violinist Paul Sachs and keyboard player Robert Norton toured with Sonia's acid folk band until 1996, playing Glastonbury and other festivals year after year. Since 2000, Sonia has been working with composer, producer, cellist, violinist Marvin Ayers, known for his unique manipulation of sound textures and audio-visual installations. You have two releases as Mask, Heavy Pedal, The Tenebrous Odyssey of Jack and Virginia, and Technopia. Marvin Ayers produced the 2012 Curved Air Live Atmosphere CD. The constant flame leading Curved Air through the decades, Sonia Cristina's hypnotic attraction endures today, vibrant and edgy as ever. Sonia, the original prog diva, gives a charismatic and highly visual performance, looking like a glamorous gypsy queen with her flowing red hair and dressed in sparkly black. That signature voice is still smoky and seductive as she spins around the stage around the excellent musicians who are Curved Air. Please welcome to Interviewing the Legends, English singer, songwriter, musician, and actress, best known for starring in the seminal 1960s musical Hair and for being the lead vocalist of the 1970s progressive rock band Curved Air, Sonia Cristina. Hello, Sonia.
Hello, hello.
You know, you would be perfect in Game of Thrones.
I would. I like all the costumes they wear and everything. I like that look. I'll go with that. Yeah.
You'll go with that. Are you a fan of the show?
I've watched a few episodes. I'm not I binge watch other things. I like Mr. Robot and Black Mirror. They were the ones, the series that really got me.
I always thought of you and Annie Haslam and Ian Anderson. You three would make great performances.
Music?
In that movie, in that show, Game of Thrones. You guys would be perfect. Even just your music itself would be perfect.
Okay. And, if you set us up for that, that sounds like a really good.
Well, unfortunately, I think they're on the last season, so maybe on the second time around. By the way, Annie Haslam gives her love to you. Just talked to her, and she's going to be on the show next week. So she gives you her best.
Give mine back to her too. We had a really nice tour together in the UK, and it was last year, I think,
mm-hmm.
or the year before.
Who were some of the music artists that inspired you? I know you were a big Dusty Springfield fan, correct?
Yeah, when I in the sort of early early 60s, whenever she was, I first noticed her when she was in the Springfields, and then I kind of followed her career, and there was nobody else as powerful as her, sort of in the English pop scene. At the time, but I mean, I just really liked her presence and her voice, and she just seemed to have a big audience amongst young people, and she brought the sound of Motown and soul and you know, all those things. She was one of the people who brought that to the British audience.
Another great artist was Petula Clark, but I've talked to Petula, and she says the same thing about Dusty, that she really admired her, and she was, a good friend as well.
Yeah, so I think she was iconic, had an iconic look, her smoky dark eyes and her beehive.
Yeah. Well, when did you first realize that you could sing? I mean, you know, some people start out and they can't sing at all, and then they evolve into it. But how was that with you? I mean, did you know at an early age that you were a singer?
Well, I mean, fairly early. But I remember my grandmother, who was a Swedish actress,
mm-hmm.
and she used to say, you know, when I sang, she said, "Oh, too much breath," you know, when I was a little girl. And then I didn't sort of pay much attention to it, but that's something that I remember. But I remember singing in a school carol concert when I must have been about 8 or 9 or something. And I sang a verse of the Holly and the Ivy, and there were sort of appreciative noises coming from the audience there, just one verse, and I enjoyed that. That was the first time I sang in public, I think.
So you knew early on that you did have a good voice, and you didn't really have to you didn't take lessons or anything like that as a child. You just had natural ability, I guess.
I did do poetry. Mm-hmm. What they call in England elocution things when I was
right.
Also sort of pre-7, and I did some poetry speaking competitions. So when you learn a poem, and then you everybody takes turns to do their recitations and things, and I did very well with that. I won a couple of those, and I enjoyed that because I just enjoyed the feeling of putting what was into my head into other people's heads, sort of just imagining into the silence with my words, if that makes any sense.
Sure. I remember the old days when beatniks first came out. I guess beatniks were the first hippies. And they used to have the little cafes, and they used to, you know, people would just walk up there and do their thing, and a lot of times their backs to the audience. And the bongos.
Yeah. Well, I did that. I did exactly that in 1967 when I came to London and I was going to, you know, proper drama college, and I had the chance of running a Wednesday evening event at, you know, a regular event at the Troubadour, the famous Troubadour
sure.
Club in Hills Court, and it was there were two Red Sullivan and Martin Windsor. They normally ran it, but they were going away. So I said, "Oh, I can run it for you whilst you're away." And so that turned into a real sort of hippies extravaganza. There was this tiny, tiny little intimate club, but we had a light show and we had bongo battles and we had poets reading with their back to the audience, just as you said. And Dave Cousins from the Straubs, he mm-hmm. was a friend of mine who came and sang down there, and Al Stewart as well. And I did my little sort of, my funny little kind of hippie ditties and melodramas, you know, yeah, melodramatic songs, you know. Well, I mean, they seem melodramatic to me now, but they were kind of, I don't know, sort of doleful then, I guess.
did you play the bongos too while you were reciting, or?
No. I was singing. I was playing guitar and singing.
Okay.
And, I mean, it was like we still had the music element, but we added the poetry and mm-hmm. you know, various other instruments and the visuals and things as well. And it was very serendipitous. People would turn up, you know, who would be really good for the evening. You know, the lighting people I met, you know, on the underground. I talked to somebody next to me and said, "You don't happen to do lights, do you?" And he did, you know, so he came and did our lights for us. Yeah.
You're an excellent guitar player. I mean, your picking is awesome, by the way. And
my finger.
So sometimes I think that's yeah. overlooked because of your beautiful voice.
Yeah. Well, when I was I played folk clubs from 13 till, and you know, right up until after Hare, when I was in Curvedere, I played guitar with on Melinda,
mm-hmm.
but that wasn't until the third album. But I can't remember what it's called. It'll come back to me. The finger pecking thing. I keep thinking crawdaddy, but that's not the right thing for it. There's a term for it. Do you know what it is? The because dang deca 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 dang deca deca deca. There's a name for that kind of picking. I'm getting old and words disappear.
Chet Atkins type picking or?
Yeah, it was more like John Renbourn and Davy Graham.
Okay.
They were the ones that everybody learned it from. So,
right.
And that was, I remember people teaching me that, and that you know, and spending hours practicing it, and it became sort of the basic, you know, mm-hmm. the basic accompaniment style, you know, the basis for the kind of singer songwriter. Backings and things. I'm sure Sandy Denny did that style as well.
Yep, Melinda's probably one of my favorite songs. That's a beautiful song, and it really highlights your guitar playing. It's your voice, both of them. It's a beautiful song. I really love it.
Thank you.
You met some pretty interesting people back in the early days. One of them was Donovan, who I've been trying to get on the show for a long, long time, but haven't had any success. I love Donovan. I think when he first came out, he was so cool. Everybody throwing flowers at him, and him sitting in the middle, you know, kind of in a yoga position. And you also knew Brian Jones. What was Brian like? Not too many people talk about, you know, what he was like and his personality and everything.
Well, I just had a very, very short, you know, period of time. I met him down at the speakeasy, and
right.
And we got chatting, and you know, and he was just very laid back and kind of, you know, and a bit out of it. And we went back to his, he was with a group of other people, and his manager. At the time, I can't remember all the names now, but we drove back to his apartment, which was in Chelsea, and he was very anxious when he was in the car, because for some reason he said that he was just he couldn't drive anymore. He was scared of driving. I wasn't quite sure what had happened to make him scared of driving. But then we went back to his place, and he was on and off of the phone listening to the mixes from the studio, which was like, I think, of Satanic Majesties they were recording.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And he was playing the recordings from Juzuka. He'd just come back from Juzuka and from meeting the master musicians who he immortalized on that album. And that was really interesting, because that was all very new, and he was very excited about that. And he was chatty and you know, very, very into the projects that he was doing, you know, into the Satanic Majesties, what became Satanic Majesties and things. I found him, you know, he was nice. You know, in that company, he just was kind of laid back and very, very sweet.
He was kind of like maybe like the George Harrison of the Stones. He played the sitar, and yeah, he was a great artist. He really was.
Multi instrument. He could play. Yeah. He could music on anything. You know.
Yeah.
I hung out with him for a little while, but I was at college and things, so I didn't have that much time, and he was away a lot, and time went on.
Did you know any of the Beatles?
No, they all came to, it was the Rolling Stones, all the Rolling Stones, I think, Mick Jagger and I remember in particular came to Hare. I met Paul McCartney at a gallery when Linda was having a it was a gallery for Linda's photographs.
Right.
And I bought a beautiful photograph of John Lennon that she had taken. I love John Lennon's work. You know, he's an artist that can really move me. One very early on, more than. The rest of the Beatles. In the beginning, I wasn't when we were. I was 15, 16. You were either a Beatles or a Stones fan. And I was definitely a Stones, but I grew to like the Beatles. But I was saying that I met Paul McCartney and Linda, and I was living. Stuart and I had a house in the countryside with fields, and local farmers grazed their sheep there, and so at this in this art gallery, Paul and Linda and I were talking about sheep, you know, about grazing sheep on your land. I remember that. So that was the only time that I've met a Beatle, but you know, it was nice. That was an unusual to talk about, I think.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to interview Julian. You know, the only Beatles I got close to was Julian, Pete Best, and Peter Asher. I had to talk to Peter Asher, good guy. But Julian was he's such a nice guy, and I love his music. You know, he should have probably been a lot more famous than he was.
Julian Lennon.
Yeah, Julian. Yep.
Yeah. I follow him on Facebook. He puts some lovely stuff up on Facebook.
Yeah, he takes some great photography as well. He's a very, very good picture taker. He attends a lot of his art gallery. He's got a lot of art showings and things like that. And he's big on the Lupus Foundation as well. He's very, very big. He's got a lot of causes. You know, he's a good guy. He really is.
The White Feather, which is for indigenous.
White Feather, right.
I've just remembered the name of that picking style. It's called Clawhammer.
Oh, Clawhammer. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I was thinking Crawdaddy. It sounds similar, but no, it was Clawhammer. Yeah. The Clawhammer picking style. That's what
right.
I do, Melinda. Okay, where were we?
Talking about Julian, I guess.
Yeah.
But he's he's a good guy. You know, love his music. I've always loved his music, and You know, talking to him on the phone is just like talking to John. It's amazing.
It
really had a lot of life.
Similar.
Yeah. I chatted with Daryl Way, another great guy. We went over his when he released Children of the Cosmos, and I did a review of that. Did you and Daryl still talk back and forth, or working on anything?
Well, we worked together in 2008,
right?
And that was good then. So getting the show back together and things, and then when it came to doing, we were trying to write new material together, but we just couldn't see eye to eye on that. And then he got tired of touring, so he doesn't like to sort of to go on long tours and things, and I love it. So, you know, since then we did our 45th anniversary, mm-hmm. With the current lineup, with Paul Sachs and Robert Norton, and Francis was too anxious. He didn't join us for that. Florian was already playing drums with us, and so Daryl and Paul and the current Daryl and Paul Sachs, they played together for the encores of our show. We did the whole we played the whole of Air Conditioning, not before Daryl came on, but with the band we played Air Conditioning, and then Daryl came on and played, and Ian Eyre, who was our actually second best bass player, but he also came on and played for Backstreet Love, and Daryl and him and the entire current band played together. So that's the last time I saw Daryl, and yes, he that was really nice. You know, he was very, very charming and mellow, and he really liked what we were doing, which was a relief. You know, he did what he we were doing his work justice.
Yeah, you guys make a good team. You know, he's a incredible violinist. And love his
yes.
style.
Yeah. Yes, it's very, very sweet.
Yeah. And he's put out some very good solo albums as well. He really has. North Star, that was your most recent album that had some new material on it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Which was.
Yeah. We did it all. It was composed. We all worked with the last. The lineup that sort of evolved from when Daryl and I got together in 2008, you know, we've carried on and carried on, and a couple of members have come and gone and come back again, but everybody in the band, it was very collaborative. People came up with different ideas and we evolved them together. And it was a very intense time because they live all over the country, and they have to travel a long way, and we had to put them up so together so that we could work on things together. And it was intense. It got quite heated, but I think we came out with an excellent album. And by the end, it was just so it was so democratic. Nobody did anything, you know. When we were mixing it, you know, they made absolutely certain that everybody was happy with the way that their lines, with what they played and how it sounded and things like that. So I've never had that experience before in a studio, apart from with the first Acid Folk album, and that was good fun to record, and that was. Even though it was my album, as opposed to everybody's album, but it did, you know, we did work very collaboratively on that as well. But you know, so with North Star, I'm really, really proud of it, and you know, I think it's that the songs from the Acid Folk, Air Conditioning, Air Cut, and North Star, they're my favourite albums out of the whole Herve Dare repertoire.
Well, that's one of my favorite albums as well. I gave it 5 stars. I think it was a fantastic album. I think one of my favorite songs was Time Games, and very Frank Zappa-like, you know, like you got the fusion, brilliant guitar work. Who was the guitar, who played the on the new tracks? Was that Kirby Gregory or was it Kit Morgan? Who was?
It was Kirby played on the album.
Right.
Kit created the, Kit was part of the collaborative creative process.
Songwriting.
But then he was unwell, and he couldn't carry on. You know, his mood was very low. He was ill, and
right.
So we were just ready. We just put down the basic sort of tracks for the feel of, you know, because we also wanted it to be, you know, to be a live performance, you know, not created bit by bit by bit.
Sure.
You know, that, you know, no click tracks allowed. I hate them. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
I like music to flow as it's meant to flow. So we had all these, we had the songs down, and then it was just Kit's guitar. You know, it wasn't really finished. It wasn't up to standards. You know, it was not something that he was proud of or anything. And you know, he just walked away from it all at that point. And so we got Kirby in to, and Kirby said, "Okay, you know." And so he listened to what had been done, and then he evolved the parts. He didn't. He took from what Kit had been doing. And created, you know, did things in his own way, which was an interesting thing to do. And then there had to be some adjustments done with the arrangements, just so that everybody else was happy with the way that their parts then fitted with Kirby's parts. It was a very, very strange way to evolve for parts. You know, you put a new part on, and then you have to change other parts underneath to make it all sit perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But it was wonderful to have Kirby back there and to hear that sound again, which, you know, which is just the same as he has when he was a young boy. In, I think he was 18 when he played with us in 1973.
Wow.
With Eddie Jobson and all.
Yeah. Kirby's amazing, man. What a guitar player. I mean, I was, you know, I was blown away by this album. And everybody needs to buy this album. Curved Air's North Star. It's available on Amazon. And like I said, I gave it 5 stars. You got a lot of great reviews on that, too, as well.
Yeah.
When I checked, yeah.
Everybody, you know, really it's very positive about it. Some of them
mm-hmm.
have a couple of rules about the fact that we do some covers and things like that, but they remember that's a long story how that came about. But it's sort of do you want to hear the story?
Sure.
It's just about, yeah, no, it was just that the we were offered a record deal by Cleopatra Records,
right?
And they, which was great. They gave us an advance and all, and then they sent this contract through. And they said, you know, they wanted on this album they wanted to have 3 covers and 3 re-records. You know, and I was completely, you know, I was really against the idea. So what on earth do they want those for? You know, we want to do a whole album of new material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got enough stuff and everything, but they were adamant that that's what they wanted. And then so we worked the re-records and the covers. We took them and created them as though they were our own creations. So we got when I got them, so that they felt right for me to sing. We didn't. I chose the songs that I felt were important songs to cover. You know, we did Across the Universe and the snow patrols,
chasing cars.
And the police, Spirits in the Material World. I think they're important songs. They're good, you know, and it was just in a way a privilege to give one's own pass to them. So we made it work. We made the whole album flow, and then went back to Cleopatra. And they said, "Well, where's Backstreet Love?" And there'd be nothing in this, in this contract that had said we had to do Backstreet Love. You know, this was completely new news to us, and so we paid them back, and released it ourselves. You know, or released it through. I think it was through Cherry Red that it came out. That was our first album, sort of Curved Air Records, by the same label that released Live Atmosphere. But I mean, it was just so bizarre. I mean, they turned down a wonderful album because it didn't have Backstreet Love on it. You know, why should we do Backstreet Love? And we're a brand new band, you know. And it says it was just crazy what record companies want sometimes, even in this day and age with enlightened ones, which I believe Cleopatra are a very good label with some, you know, they really support artists and stuff. But this was madness.
yeah. You don't want to do a greatest hits album.
No. <You know.
laughs> another favorite track, Images and Signs. Was that a new track? That's a new track.
That's new. Images and Signs, and yeah, most of it is new.
Love it. Oh my goodness, you guys, you know, you just rocked it there. It you know, it reminded me of a little bit. You know, Camel, the prog rock band Camel, sounded a little bit like that kind of orchestration. I loved it. It was awesome.
Our keyboard player is brilliant. I mean, Robert Norton, who stepped into Francis Monkman's shoes and sort of keyboard department. I mean, he just covers all that. He has all the different sounds at his disposal, and he's very intuitive with, his arrangements and, you know, the right chords, the right sound, the right inversion, you know, for everything. You know, I mean, he doesn't write it down. He just feels it, you know, and you know, there are three of us, like Paul and me and Kirby. We don't read music or understand, you know, what all these chords and things are called. You know, then you get people like Kit and Robert, who, you know, they can talk about all the different, the nuances of all these different inversions and, you know, this flattened fifth, 11th, seventh, whatever, the 13th, you know, they have different names and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's a whole science of its own, you know, whereas Kirby will do stuff, but he won't know what it's called. Neither will Stuart.
Right.
Stuart Copeland. He had some basic music stuff, but I mean, he doesn't. He just intuits stuff as well and builds it up empirically. He doesn't know what he's doing at all. Nothing's done according to any preconceived, you know, any formula. It's all just as it needs to be, which is the way I think music should be too.
Sure. I want to make sure the audience knows about what else you got going on. I've noticed on your site you have a re-release of the second album, expanded edition from Esteric Recordings, which I think was just re-released right in August of this year. Which
Air Conditioning has been re-released.
Okay.
The first three albums have been remastered by Francis Monkman because he, you know, which makes him happy. It brings him sort of into this, you know, has him working, you know, in these times along with everybody else that we're working with. And we're also doing a Curved Air family album, which will come out next year.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
Which is has pieces from everybody who's ever worked with us, more or less.
That's wonderful.
And collaborations. But so, yes, the first three albums and Air Cut.
Mm-hmm.
So Air Conditioning, second album, Phantasmagoria, and Air Cut have been remastered and released with bonus tracks and lovely, beautiful packaging and everything. They're CDs, but they're just, it's all beautifully done, and they're being very well received too. And I think they made for Record Store Day, which is a big thing in England. Do you have it in America as well?
Yes, we do.
Record Store Day. They've made some more picture discs, like, you know, LPs on,
right,
with the original artwork on. So I haven't actually seen the new ones, but it's good that they've got some new ones out, which will actually play, you know, like properly, because the technology wasn't there when our first picture disc came out. It was just plastic on top of the artwork, and or clear vinyl on top of the artwork, which sort of was a bit staticky. But other than that, the music came through.
I'm baffled when I think about how huge Curved Air should be. You know, why couldn't they be as big as maybe Emerson, Lake and Palmer, you know, for instance? And it still baffles me today, because you have a tremendous following. If anybody goes on YouTube and checks out all your music, you've got so many people, you know, making comments and liking your videos, and so many views. It's incredible. You got a tremendous following. Why do you think you guys didn't make it commercially, like say in Emerson, Lake and Palmer?
Well, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, they carried on, you know, for many years in one way or as far as I know, with, you know, that lineup kept going. The same thing with Led Zeppelin. They kept going.
Right.
You know, it's keeping going with the original creators, because every time you when you have that, the original band, and then you hand the baton to some new people,
mm-hmm,
you know, then they have to earn the respect of everybody else. And so when the Air Cut band joined, you know, they were hand picked they were kids, really talented young. Kirby was 19, Eddie was 17. And you know, it was a brilliant album. But then after a year, they got you know, Roxy Music stole Eddie,
yep,
and Eddie went very willingly, and because you discover that, you know, that people, even with Daryl and Francis, I mean, they just made through nearly 3 years. But, you know, they already got burnt out, and they wanted to do their own thing, you know, because it's very difficult to keep people together who are really talented. And, you know, because there'll come a point, you know, even with the Police, they made it through 5 years.
Right.
You know, that it's just for people to say, no, I mean, I want to do my own thing now. You know, it's just kind of, I want to do it my own way. I don't want to have to kind of, you know, carry on making the same sound or working with these people, whereas it's all a big love affair at the beginning, and then it's just like a marriage, really.
Sure.
A band, you know, it's either people are prepared to work on it and see it through for years and years and years, or else it's just a wonderful, flaming, passionate thing, which is very beautiful. But when, you know, it lasts about the same amount of time as a you know, a romantic relationship sort of starts to sort of fade after about 3 years. By 5 years, it's often gone, and 7 years or whatever. You know, unless it's those the special people who will learn how to love, and it, well, that's a whole other subject. You know, to keep something going, which I think,
sure,
is rare but beautiful, or rare in my experience, But I think that was why the bands that are really big who kept going, you know, the Stones, Zeppelin, Renaissance, kind of they broke into pieces and came back together again several times, and
right.
You know, but I think because Eddie went off and then there was a gap after the Air Cut Band. It wasn't really very long, but we got together and did a very successful tour with the original lineup again. But that was basically for financial reasons, because we had some taxes to pay as a band, you know. Mm. So they booked a 3-week tour, a 3-week sellout tour in universities, which was, you know, really, really, really nice places to play, playing to that age group. And then Daryl and I continued. And for me, that last lineup of Stuart was with us, but that was one good thing. And it was all really, you know, everybody was really good players and things too. But Daryl was already beginning to sort of meddle with what Curved Air was. You know, he was playing with, he was making it more pop and more, you know, the overall sound of the album was only just like one or two tracks on there where Daryl sort of he plays with it, making it sound like, you know, like something from one of the first three albums. But it's sort of, you know, he was just, and the other musicians were much more sort of bluesy, and you know, Daryl was having his sort of bluesy poppy moment, and right. And I think that diluted those albums. I mean, they're good albums, and the new material went down very well live because it was mixed in with the old stuff, but it wasn't, you know, I was kind of dragging my heels with that too. It just sort of, you know, it just wasn't going in the right direction. And anyway, I wanted to kind of leave and go and do acting and things like that. And mm-hmm. And so, you know, when it broke up in 1976, just before punk arrived, you know, it was just in time for me, you know, just because I wanted to do other things, and other things were happening in the world too for us to be part of.
Well, were you happy with management and the exposure the band got?
Yeah, I mean, different Miles in the sort of the Daryl era.
Uh-huh.
You know, Miles Copeland, who's Stuart's brother, Miles. I mean, mm-hmm. we did, you know, they were proper management. We got some of our best coverage from the from the music papers. I mean, there was a lot in the press about us, you know, and I was they had sort of press polls and things, we were all sort of, you know, they sort of top musicians and top vocalists and things like that, and so we were very popular all the way through. So I think then one thing that happened with Miles was, which wasn't good, was our first album together. I think this is where the light began to die. Was we all got together, the new band, Daryl and Stuart and Mick Jakes and Phil Cohn then, and we wrote when my friend Norma, who was writing lyrics for me, because I'd just been through a rough time and I couldn't string words together, never mind a song. Mm-hmm. But Norma and I kind of, you know, I talked to Norma and she sketched out songs, and then I thought, yeah, well, that's a song, and that's not a song, that's a song, and so we made some songs, and we went and we recorded it in Island Studios, Basing Street Studios, and we gave it to the whatever label Miles was working with, because he was BTM Records, and this was RCA, and they turned it down. This it was the first one, Midnight Wire. And so Miles got in these Ron and Howie Albert from Muscle Shoals studio.
Right.
And they came in and they sat, you've got to change, you know, all the lyrics on this, they wanted to make us into a kind of, you know, slick kind of, I don't know, American kind of whatever a Muscle Shoals type band would be. I mean, like a sort of bluesy, West Coasty, you know, they just wanted it to be all homogenous, if that's the right word. I mean, the album that we had made was very quirky and very, you know, we enjoyed playing it. But when Ron and Howie were working with us, they just kind of took all the kind of fun out of it and just made it very straight, you know, and it's all played. It's very, very polished, and everybody except me, they liked what I was doing. But everybody else got a hard time. They told Stuart that he needed to practice with a metronome. And, you know, Daryl was miserable, you know, because we were having, you know, our lovely work that we created, we were so excited about. You know, we were having to kind of water it down. So, you know, that was a miserable time. So, you know, so that being, you know, we did two albums together. We did Midnight Wire and then Airborne. By the time we got to the studio, I don't think that Airborne was, you know, that was kind of everybody sort of at loggerheads over their own particular song. It wasn't really a collaboration. It was just the songwriter led, you know, produced each song, and you know, so it was what it was, and you know, and it worked, and people like the tracks. But so this is why, I mean, it was time we weren't really doing, you know, apart from playing the old, playing the kind of the best of what had been created up until then. And we weren't playing air cut stuff then. We were just playing stuff that Daryl had written.
Right.
And Daryl and Francis had written, you know, but the new stuff just didn't cut it as far as everything else went. So that this is why we didn't continue. But if we had, yeah, but we couldn't continue because the you know, the main fire kept sort of dying, burning out,
right.
You know, and then we had to, but there were some embers that obviously that we when we got back together again and. In 1990, we got back together and did with Daryl and Florian and me and Francis, and we did two shows, which were very, very well received. But there weren't no press came at all. You know,
really?
We just two shows done. Yeah, and there was no reviews. It was wonderful. You know, we had really, really good light show. Fruit Salad Lights, who were the best people at the time, and the shows went down really well. And then everybody went off in there. We sort of kind of talked about maybe we would carry on, but we didn't. Anyway, I was doing acid folk and things at the time, which that really had, you know, had me on fire doing acid folk, and because that was my songs and.
Yep.
And you know, my wonderful players who played beautifully freely, and so you know that was the Curved Air at that point was no competition to acid folk. So anyway, I mean, if that answers your question as why we didn't carry on, because then
right.
There was a big gap until 19
sure.
until 2008, and
yeah.
Then from then we've been and in 2008. We couldn't find anybody, you know. We were trying to get publicity then, you know. We were just taking it upon ourselves to just do, you know, go out and do some shows and things. We didn't have big management or anything then. We had
right.
we had somebody helping us out, and then we had somebody else helping us out, and they were trying to get press for us. And it just the people who were in the press offices of the music magazines or whatever. I mean, they probably weren't even. You know, they didn't even know who Curved Air were, you know.
that's pretty sad.
But then, but we kept going, then you know, and as we kept going, the prog, you know, the appetite for prog music was growing, and that beautiful prog magazine, and which is released, which is available all over the world, and then there was you know, prog festivals and you know, big festivals that had, you know, had you know, progressive music stages, and you know, so it began to flower again, and there are young prog bands, which is exciting, you know, who do. It's very strange. We did a show in Italy, and I listened to lots of the other bands, and they all, you know, you could hear, well, that band sort of sounds like, you know, but like Genesis, and you know, in this era and that era, and they, and another band, you know, sounded a little bit like King Crimson, and yep. Or you know, they were obvious. The starting points, influences that had sort of set them off, but I mean that they, you know, they there are some really we've played several progressive, well, lots of progressive rock festivals now. There's one in Portugal that we do quite regularly, and then the wonderful bands from all over the world, very creative, truly sort of eclectic, like progressive. Rock bands always were. I mean, there was no such thing as you know, each progressive rock band was different from. They were all different from each other. You know, you couldn't say that one band, that Genesis, wasn't like King Crimson, wasn't like Led Zeppelin.
Exactly. There's a lot of great new prog bands out there. I just interviewed Bruce Sword from the Pineapple Thief. Have you heard of them? The Pineapple Thief?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how many have surfaced. And there's a radio station called Moro that is promoting a lot of the new prog rock bands. It's Morow. And that's all they do, is they promote prog rock, and they have the older bands, and they have a lot of the newer bands. So it's cool, because you can discover a lot of the new progressive rock bands that are out there. So I'm really happy about that. At least prog rock's making kind of like a comeback, you know, with all the young people.
Yeah, and it just is taking its place alongside sort of whatever, you know, there's indie, and there's rock and roll, and there's reggae,
right.
And there's, you know, and so, you know, prog rock it had run its course again. In 1976, you know, people were ready for the fresh energy of
yep.
fresh pop energy of punk, but now, you know, it can lead the youngsters on again.
Like, prog rock is all about the Brits. I give the Brits 1,000% credit for inventing progressive rock. I just talked to John Lodge from the Moody Blues, and you know, I was giving him giving the Brits all the credit, and he was saying, oh, you know, that we copied the American rock and roll and this. I said, no, John, prog rock is you guys. It's in your blood, man. It's in your DNA. It comes back. You know, you can feel the medieval, the British history. You know what I mean? It's all coming through. Through prog rock, it's all a Brit thing, and because that's my favorite music. I love progressive rock. I've always have, and I give the Brits a lot of credit for that.
But I think, you know, at the same time, I mean, like Jerry Goodman and the Flock and the Mahavishnu Orchestra and
right.
Frank Zappa, even, you know what I mean? It's all these people who'd messed up rock music in the nice
right.
best sense of the word.
Right.
You know what I mean? They just using what was vaguely, you know, which has a rock, had a beat and things like that. But they added sort of poetry and humor and anarchy and everything.
Right.
You know, and all that is all prog as well. You know, it's progressive. you know, whereas you still had the bands who were playing, you know, beautiful straight, the Johnny Winters and the Edgar Winters and all of these people who were playing, you know, they were playing things, but in a particular style. They were being true to a particular kind of canon of work. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I mean, either they were following on from the blues people and things like that. You know, just it's interesting just how the different threads, you know, from the rock and roll and blues, mm-hmm. you know, how it's all worked its way through and people begin to, you know, I'm a great believer in not following a template, you know, because I think I taught singing at a university in England, and they had a jazz course, and every time they did a recital, it was most boring thing on the planet because everybody just sounded like Rent a Jazz Band. You know what I mean?
Right.
They taught them all the different styles from here, yeah. there, and whatever. But there was, you know, the really great players that came through in that course were the ones who never had any of that learning. You know, they just
amazing,
did it from their soul.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a rehearsed band, and then somebody that just goes in there and improvises. You know, I talked to Billy Cobham about the Spectrum album. That was all improvised. You know, and it came out to be an incredible album. You know, and they did it really quickly. So sometimes it's good to have mistakes in music. You know, it sounds good. Sounds better. Here's a question that I ask everybody, and I get some interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
David Bowie.
Good answer. I don't think I've had a David. I don't think I've had an answer from David Bowie yet. It's amazing.
No, well, he's the one person. I mean, I'll never get to meet him now, but I mean, who's real hero of mine, you know,
right.
the way he kind of used personas and mixed, you know, took influences from different places, and the way he just sort of went for it, you know, he went right out on a limb personally and everything, and you know, he just.
Yep.
Was kind of like the, you know, he really was like the Andy Warhol of rock of pop music, you know.
Yeah, all the way to the end. It's amazing.
Yeah.
All the way when he knew he was going to pass away, he kept it going. He's brilliant. I agree with you. Sonia, we got to wrap this up. We're getting close to that time. I want to thank you so much for being my guest today, especially for all the incredible music you brought to us and continue to bring. Please come to America. When was the last time you've been here? It's been a while, huh?
We haven't played over there for a long time.
Right.
No,
right.
We did the cruise. We did the prog rock cruise.
Right.
A couple of years ago, and so we were briefly in Tampa, Florida, when I come to America, my son lives in America. One of my sons lives in America. Stuart lives in LA, and you know, but we. So I have reasons to visit sometimes,
right.
but we may be able to come over there. I don't know. We'll have to see. It all depends on you know, promoters being able to put on the right kind of tour.
Sure. Well, Sonia, we love Curved Air. We love you. You were awesome.
Thank you.
The band is great. It's as good as ever, and we just want more music from you guys. Thanks again for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
For more information about Curved Air, visit www.curvedair.com or www.facebook.com/curvedair or visit www.soniacristina.com. And go on their website because they have a lot of great albums that have been remastered. You can purchase the second album, a two-disc expanded edition from Esteric Recordings. Phantasmagoria album, remastered in an expanded edition, two-disc expanded edition. also from historic recordings. And go on their website to check that out. You can also go on Amazon.com. Very special thanks to Barrick Wickens, manager and tour manager, for arranging this interview with Sonia Christina. And, of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of the Ray Sasso Show. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Sasso, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, the True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. You will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.